evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, March 21st, 2016. The UN mission in South Sudan says operating in the country is just difficult.
Even though we are a Chapter 7 mission, we have to actually to get from the government authorization through our patrolling and sometimes even through our flights. And it's not always easy.
And gunmen kidnap wildlife officers and steal weapons.
It is too much for us. We cannot be able to bear it. You can imagine we were born during the time of war. We grew during the time of war. We got children during the time of war. Up to when are we going to continue with such kind of behavior?
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Local officials say a group of gunmen kidnapped three wildlife officers on duty in the newly created Yei State's Morobo County over the weekend. They say the gunmen also stole dozens of machine guns. VOA fellow Tito Justin reports from Yei.
County officials say this is the first kidnapping and robbery in Morobo County since the fighting broke out in Juba in late 2013 and spread across the country. Toti Jacob, Commissioner of Morobo County, says the unidentified gunmen stole 40 guns, including AK-47s. He says the attackers are still at large.
If they are rebels, rebels have their leaders. They would have shown themselves that we are under command of Mr. X. But up to now, we have not seen who is responsible for this group. Number two, we have not established exactly where they are staying. They are just moving among the people and doing all this business of theirs.
Jacob says SPLA forces and wildlife officers failed to pursue the attackers. The attack comes nearly 2 weeks after a group of armed men looted several business people who were traveling in seven vehicles on the Yei Morob Road, leaving one woman injured. Yei Deputy Governor Brigadier General Abraham Wani says this latest attack in Yei State is nothing new. He says there is general insecurity in South Sudan. Wani believes the gunmen are rebels operating underground and blames government forces for not responding to such attacks more quickly, which he says is caused by poor infrastructure.
The government of the Yei State came recently from Juba. The same situation, the insecurity that is happening in Yei started before our coming. We have poor roads, lack of transport. Our forces here, they could not catch up in time. If I thought they were to get these outlaws, definitely they would confront them.
Yei State has no history of vigilant groups operating in any parts of the state. Jacob is calling on residents to fully cooperate with the security agents in identifying individuals causing insecurity in the area.
I wanted to ask our public to cooperate with us because it is too much for us. We cannot be able to bear it. You can imagine we were born during the time of war. We grew during the time of war. We got children during the time of war. Up to when are we going to continue with such kind of behavior? I don't see any reason of somebody to rebel against the government when people are coming back to implementation of the CPA-2.
Morobo County is located near the borders of Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. For VOA News, I am Tiro Justin in Yei.
SPLM in opposition says its first group of military and police personnel will not arrive in Juba today as scheduled because of logistical reasons. SPLM IO lead negotiator Taban Dengai says the opposition lacks resources it needs to transport its forces to Juba. He also accused the government and international supporters of reneging on their pledges to cover transportation costs. Philip Thornaleo reports for VOA from Juba.
Taban Dengai blames the delay of the SPLM-IO forces' arrival to Juba on the government and the problems with the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC.
The first unit of 40 officers and men who were scheduled to arrive into Juba today, 21st March 2016, from Kardab, were delayed by JMEC for logistical. The 23 senior officers from JIP who were supposed to arrive to Juba also today, 21st March 2016,
were also delayed because the government of the Republic of South Sudan denied UN flight clearance to Pagak.
Pagak is located at the South Sudan-Ethiopia border and is the headquarters of the SPLM-IO. Repeated attempts to contact government officials for comment were not successful, but Information Minister Michael Makuei told reporters recently that the government will cooperate with international partners who have pledged to transport the opposition forces to Juba. Guy did not say when the opposition forces are now expected to arrive. He says opposition leader and first vice president designate Riek Machar will only come to Juba after his bodyguards have arrived. Government officials and others believe Machar's arrival will break the logjam forming the long-awaited transitional government of national unity. Guy insists the delay in forming transitional government is not the fault of the SPLM-IO.
We have always been ahead of our partners on this roadmap of implementation. This agreement is in spirit a letter to quickly rescue our country from imminent collapse and alleviate the suffering of our people. Unfortunately, we lack the needed resources to speed up the process as demanded by our people, and we have made that abundantly clear to the government of South Sudan and all partners in this process.
The Troika countries, the United States, Norway and Britain have said recently that they will transport SPLM-IO forces but not their heavy weapons, including rocket-propelled grenades. They say that is not part of their policy and will not be accepted by their taxpayers back home as part of the peace implementation process. Guy says the SPLM-IO and the government should cooperate to fully implement the peace agreement if donors fail to honor their commitment.
The government of South Sudan, we have appealed to them also. We appealed to them that they could come in. They could come in at the government of the day if JMAC and Troika failed to transport these forces.
According to the compromise security arrangement agreed to in February, more than 1,300 SPLM-IO forces will be brought to Juba before Riek Machar's return to the capital. Guy says the government and his party has not agreed on containment areas in Greater Equatoria and the Greater Bahr Ghazal areas, and warns that this disagreement could derail the implementation of the peace agreement. For VOA News, I am Philip Onanleu in Juba.
South Sudanese living in Sudan say they are worried about Sudan's recent decision to start treating them as foreigners. The Sudanese Council of Ministers decided last week that South Sudanese living in the country will no longer be able to enjoy benefits of citizenship, such as access to education and health care. Last week, Sudan threatened to close its borders with South Sudan, saying Juba is supporting rebels in Sudan. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio has more from Khartoum.
On Thursday, Sudan's Council of Ministers decided to treat all South Sudanese living in the country as foreigners when they seek medical services or send their kids to school in Sudan. The decision, if implemented, will affect hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese living in Sudan and some 170,000 undocumented South Sudanese refugees who recently crossed into Sudan fleeing the civil war in their own country. Up until now, South Sudanese in Sudan were treated like nationals and paid the same bills for social services. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Khartoum says it is seeking an explanation from the government as to why the decision was taken. UN officials also say they are trying to assess the implications of the decision on South Sudanese residing in Sudan. Students say they are worried about what will happen to them. 22-year-old South Sudanese Jonah Simon is a student at the Khartoum-based Al Imam Al Hadi University. Simon says he was surprised by the decision. He says they are trying to understand it, but he fears it will hurt students if their school fees are raised because their families back home are in a bad economic situation. A large number of South Sudanese living in Sudan are students trying to complete their education before they return home to help with the development of their country. Simon says Sudan should be more sympathetic to South Sudanese students. Simon says the government must be compassionate about the students, especially college students who would be hit the hardest by this decision if school tuitions are raised beyond what they can afford. Simon says I beg them to be considerate. Luca Steven, another South Sudanese in Khartoum, says he does not object to the decision to treat South Sudanese as foreigners. But Steven says he regrets it came as a result of what he calls a political squabble between Khartoum and Juba. Steven says, we were once part of this country, so for the sake of all time, such decisions should be introduced in a good manner, not as a result of a political quarrel. This is clearly political, but Steven says we will comply with the new law and we have our legal papers and everything. Steven says Juba should consider the interests of its citizens in Sudan when engaging in politics with Khartoum. He says, I say to my president, Salva Kiir, please consider our situation here in Sudan and think about our best interests and make the right intervention, even if it is to repatriate South Sudanese who do not have anything to do here in Sudan. Let him do right by us because we are the ones to be hurt when these things happen. Juba denies Sudan's accusations of supporting Sudanese rebel groups and accuses Khartoum of supporting the SPLM-IO rebels in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
Still in Sudan, a new round of talks between government of Sudan and armed rebel groups operating in Darfur, southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states began on Friday in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. But as Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Khartoum, there is little progress and no one expects a breakthrough at the talks.
The talks in Addis began with SPLM North Secretary General Yasser Arman, Sudan Liberation Movement's leader Minni Arko Minnawi, and the chairman of the National Ummah Opposition Party, As-Sadiq Al-Mahdi, and were supervised by former South African President Thabo Mbeki. Mbeki invited the parties to the talks, all of which have refused to take part in President Bashir's national dialogue in Khartoum, aimed at building confidence between the government and the opposition political parties to reach a ceasefire. Aside from negotiating a ceasefire in Darfur, South Kordofan and Blue Nile states, the rebels and opposition forces demand that national issues, such as how Sudan should be governed, be up for discussion. The government insists political issues will only be discussed with the rebels if they lay down their weapons and join the internal national dialogue. Political analyst Ismail Ibrahim says it is not likely that this round of talks will be any different from those in the past that ended in failure.
I don't think that there is anything significantly new because this is maybe the 10th round of talks at the same issue. And sometimes it looks that even the high panel itself is navigating, you know, in an open sea. Or traveling in a desert.
Ibrahim says issues that relate to governance and political change in Sudan should be discussed with all stakeholders in the country.
And that was supposed to be an issue not only just between the rebels on both sides and the government on this side, but it's something that is related or it has to be concerned with all the political forces, whether the ruling party and its allies and the opposition groups, you know, and political parties.
Ibrahim says the mediating panel should focus on engaging the government and the rebels in reaching a permanent ceasefire and security arrangements in the three areas.
This is only the government can discuss with them because the oppositions are not part of that. And they don't have anything to provide, you know, whether about the security and about whatever they say. On the other hand, the political issues that are of national character, this is not only something that between the rebels and the ruling party, but it's something that is concerning all the political forces, you know, in the Sudan.
Ibrahim says the rebels need to realize that a peaceful resolution of the conflicts in Sudan is the only way out and that political change can only come from inside the country.
I am afraid that the rebels may have at the back of their mind some kind of political deal like the Abuja agreement and also the comprehensive peace agreement between, I mean, SPLM under the leadership of Dr. Garang and the government on the other side. But I think that now the circumstances have completely and fundamentally changed. You know, even the rebels themselves on the ground, they are not as strong as before, and also they are not so united.
Mbeki is expected to arrive in Khartoum today to brief President Bashir in person on any progress at the talks. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the worst weather event that you've lived through?
I was very young and I went outside to get something and then the thunder struck. And I don't know how it happened, but I found myself on the floor. I couldn't walk.
The worst weather I've experienced is those rains which fell down for 3 days. They flooded the whole fields at our home, so it was the worst ever I've ever met.
The worst weather event, I don't really remember. But I remember when I was young, it was really raining heavily and with all the thunderstorm. And yeah, I was scared of the rain when I was young.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has appointed Nicholas Haysom as his special envoy for Sudan and South Sudan. Haysom, who is a lawyer, was a special representative of the Secretary General for United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan. Haysom was involved in the Burundi peace talks as chair of the committee negotiating constitutional issues. This week, we are taking a look at the role of the UN mission in South Sudan and how that role has evolved, how UNMISS is perceived by South Sudanese, and what the mission actually does on the ground. To begin our series, we take a look at the eve of independence, July 8, 2011, the same day UNMISS was established. The original governing mandate for UNMISS revolved around peace building and economic development. As Ayen Bior reports from Washington, that mandate has changed since then.
The peacekeeping mission in South Sudan is one of the biggest missions in the world. UNMISS has over 15,000 personnel, including 12,700 uniformed personnel made up of troops, military observers, and police. There are close to 2,000 civilian personnel and 400 volunteers. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says there are more than 1.6 million internally displaced people in South Sudan. Those are the people UNMISS tries to help and protect. Margaret Bashir, VOA's United Nations correspondent in New York, says with a limited number of troops, the mandate to protect civilians in IDP camps that typically host tens of thousands at once can be challenging at best. She says there simply are not enough peacekeepers to do the work of the mandate.
It's an issue at every peacekeeping mission. There's never enough peacekeepers. The countries are too big. There's not enough equipment. There's not enough helicopters. They can't get around. I mean, in South Sudan, during the rainy season, the only way you can get around is by helicopter. The UN doesn't have enough helicopters. Why? Because member states need to donate them and donate the troops that have the expertise to operate them.
Before the conflict flared up, UNMISS supported the government with conflict prevention activities. They helped authorities develop their capacity to provide security, establish the rule of law, and strengthen the security and justice sectors of the country. The violence that erupted in December 2013 triggered the United Nations Security Council to change its approach to assisting South Sudanese. The Security Council temporarily increased the troop size of UNMISS on Christmas Eve, just weeks after fighting broke out. By March, the UN Secretary General recommended that the Security Council temporarily shift the focus of UNMISS to the protection of civilians, a mandate which UNMISS continues to operate under today. Bashir says the protection of civilians comes with its own set of challenges. For one, she says peacekeepers are not allowed to engage in fighting in the protection of civilian camps, except when they come under attack.
They can take a self-defense posture and they can defend a camp from attack, but they can't really go out and have a military offensive sort of against the gunmen or the attackers who are threatening the camp.
UNMISS is required to oversee a mission-wide early warning strategy to prepare and prevent further attacks on UN personnel and its facilities. That includes information gathering, monitoring, and response mechanisms for responding to certain issues that might arise. Peacekeepers are required to protect civilians from external threat that disrupt the peace of the bases. But as Bashir points out, there are often issues that arise inside the camps between IDPs of different ethnic backgrounds.
There have been problems where groups within the camp have their own issues with one another, too. So it brings insecurity within the camp walls, and that's also a threat to the people. So the UN has, you know, really tried to keep the parties inside the camps, you know, civilized and be able to deal with each other.
Tensions inside the camps have made matters worse for peacekeepers. Just last month, over a third of the POC site in Malakal was destroyed by a fire because of pre-existing tensions between three different ethnic communities in the camp. Retaliatory fires were set earlier this month. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
The deputy head of UN mission in South Sudan says UNMISS continues to face challenges in executing its mandate in the country. Mustafa Shomari says despite operating under Chapter 7, there is no freedom of movement for UNMISS staff in South Sudan. Shomari says UNMISS is working under a very difficult environment.
This mandate has something very special in it because in addition to the normal kind of focus like protection of civilians, like monitoring and investigation of human rights, like facilitating the delivery of humanitarian assistance, this mandate in particular has also added a fourth pillar, very important, to support the implementation of the agreement of a resolution of conflict in South Sudan. We are already sheltering more than 190,000 internally displaced people in what we call the protection of civilians. This is the backbone of our mandate. And the approach that we are taking is through dialogue and engagement, through what we call our engagement with the communities at local level. The second one is provision of physical protection. And this is what we do, as you know, when the crisis broke, we had 100,000 internally displaced people. The idea is really to, because they came in because of their security, how do we protect them in that? And this is really the second approach that we are doing. And the third one is really how do we establish a protective environment? This is where we actually make the force, the police, and all the assets that we have. We do that through, first of all, patrolling, long-range patrolling in the cities, sometimes establishing what we call forward base, the force, so that we can create a sense of security for the population.
What are some of the challenges facing this mandate? It looks like it's a new mandate that we have not seen anywhere in the world, protecting civilians as opposed to keeping peace.
The challenge there is actually to make sure that we create ourselves an environment in which we can really give to the internally displaced people that security which is necessary. But again, as I say, you know, security always starts by yourself as a person. Sometimes we do see in the protection of civilian side some issues which are happening between, you know, conflict between different, ethnic people, or sometimes there are interests between two different persons and so on that can sometimes degenerate into conflict and so on that we have also to tackle. There are also issues that, you know, this is, it's become like a community, and in a community also you have people who are acting against any kind of law and so on. So we have experience, for example, in those sites, some people really even doing raping and so on, and that we have to deal with that and so on. And these are kind of challenges that we definitely have. In terms of really the establishment of a protecting environment, the patrolling, for us to be able to do that, you know, as you know, even though we are a Chapter 7 mission, we have to actually to get from the government authorization through our patrolling and sometimes even through our flights. And it's not always easy because it's not always understood when we do the patrolling, you know, there are some kind of suspicions and things like that and so on. And we have not always really gotten what I call the freedom of movement. We are constantly in a discussion and negotiation with the government because we want the government to understand that this is our mandate, even though the protection of civilian mandate is really the first responsibility is the government to do that. So what we are doing is really actually to support the government.
And how would you describe your working relationship with the government? You just said that sometimes you don't get the freedom of movement.
I think you need to also look at the situation as it has evolved. You know, in 2011, when the mission was established, when the government was in place and so on, at that time, actually, the mission even had a mandate in terms of really supporting capacity building, strengthening, you know, the institution, the government, and so on. And suddenly, you know, December 2013, you know, happened. And that has created a kind of suspicion. In a condition like that, we needed to actually first make sure that we make the government understand that our mandate, even though it is provided by the Security Council, we need to work with the government to be able to deliver our mandate.
That's Mustafa Somari, the deputy head of UN mission in South Sudan. We asked several South Sudanese in WAO what they think of the work of UN mission in South Sudan. Is it working? Are they doing what they are set out to do? Here is what they had to say.
I'm Muzama Asunta. If I'm given a chance of rating the work of UNMISS in South Sudan and particularly in the world, because this is where I am, I can rate it out of 10, I can give them 5. Depending on their work they do, they keep changing their mandates here and there. On capacity building, they have been doing a lot, raiding police and all this. But again, why I'm getting the other 5 away is that I see that like they are doing little at the rural area, but they are doing a lot. So I think they have to open their eyes wider in the rural area because people there are really suffering.
I'm calling Otto Simon Samuel Aboy. If to rate the work of UNMISS, I will rate at just 6. The reason being they had been protecting us somehow, and the offer that they do give to the citizens, like just the aids. And then we have other supports, like in education or construction of roads. That's why I have to rate them. But however, the other failures that makes them their work not to be rated. You know, they have failed to control or to protect the civilians. Because much as they are protecting the civilians, still assassination and killing is going on. We feel insecure because we thought UNMISS could really protect us, but to a lesser extent.
My name is Mailani Kuala Clement. So I gave 8 rate to UNMISS in South Sudan, particularly WAO. The reason why I gave 8 is I've seen their work here, in WAO particularly. I've seen what they have done. One, UNMISS, they normally give contract. They don't leave people like these cleaners. They stay for 2 to 3 years. What I've seen is they give contract of 9 months. When it finish, then they have to call for other people. It means that so many people have benefited. It's not only one, because they come in group. After 9 months, you go, and other group comes. Then when they left, the contract is over. When you come home, you are settled. Everything is secure.
I'm Ngota James Thomas. First and foremost, what good things did they do? According to me, as the South Sudanese have been monitoring, they had helped the government in infrastructural development, conditions under which government will not manage to build or construct roads or schools or hospitals, UNMISS was able to. Security-wise, UNMISS was also able to apply its mandates to help curb down insecure situations in towns. Like, I mean, WAO, a situation happened in 2012 when UNMISS never entered in with its almost the peacekeepers to contain the conditions of burning houses and other things. It was going to be terrible on civilians, but I thank God that UNMISS also succeeded in this angle of protecting civilians.
These are voices of some South Sudanese residents talking about how they view the role of UNMISS in South Sudan. We will have more on the role of UNMISS and what it has accomplished in tomorrow's program. I'm John Tanza in Washington.